have a lot of you know, great people who have decided to join us today, and so and I will. You don't want to hear me; you want to hear them. I'm going to try to make the introductions brief, but please, you know, let's all applaud very, very loudly and right on. Okay, I'm going to begin on the far right. The man who started, his career at Apple Computer, where he designed a device called the JoyPort, which allowed four game paddles and two Atari controllers to be hooked up to an Apple II. I'm just reading what it says.
And you know. He's the other half of the JoyPort, Keith Haney.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Don't jump the gun here.
Okay? Which one of you was the Joy?
I don't want to take that credit now.
Did you do the right half? Or
I think
the left
that
half?
Was me.
That's a good one.
See, they don't need me, but I have to do this anyway. And then Steve went to Atari, which is why he's up here today, and where he designed three games for the VCS. Quad Run, the first home video game with voice that didn't require extra hardware. Taz and Asterisk. And after Atari, Steve did some more work for Apple. Then he went to Tengen, created Super Sprint on the NES, worked on Sonic Spinball on the Genesis, did Waterworld on the Virtual Boy, and more recently programmed two games called Click'em and Zen Words. Steve Wojta. Sitting to his right, a man whose biography is unfortunately not written in here, but I wrote some stuff down, and he was at Atari for quite a while and did some great games. Did Berserk on the 2600, Sword Quest Earthworld, right? 2600 Mario Brothers, and Gravatar, I believe, were the his major contributions. Mr. Dan Hitchens.
Yeah. All right, Dan.
Immediately to my right, flipping back to the H section where I was, one of the top Atari programmers, such classic titles as Flag Capture, Skydiver, Steeplechase, helping out with Real Sports Volleyball, Real Sports Football, and 5200, the unreleased 5200 port of Xevious, an Atari 8-bit computer game called Micro Movie. He's worked with Epix, Sega. Contributed to such games as the Sporting News Baseball, California Games 2, Joe Montana Football, Castle of Illusion, Mr. Jim Huether.
You changed your name.
Yeah.
Immediately to my left, during his time at Atari, designed several of the other games on the Atari 5200, most notably Real Sports Baseball. Which is a game that was groundbreaking for its time. It incorporated digitized speech at a time when home video game systems otherwise required a separate add-on module for a speech synthesis. So if there's anybody out there who's interested in how to choke speech out of either the 2600 or the 5200, we've got two guys up here who can probably tell you a lot about that. Keithan Hyenga. And to his left, man who started at Commodore, designed titles for the, it's pronounced P-E-T or PET?
Yeah, PET.
PET. Baseball, stock portfolio, and blackjack. But then, surprise, surprise, he went to Atari and released such games for the Atari 8-bit computers as Hangman, Biorhythm, Mugwump. And it says right here that he really hit gold when he moved into 2600 development with such unforgettable titles as Defender, Real Sports Volleyball, Desert Falcon, Sprintmaster, and Roadrunner, and yes, designed the 2600 version of Rampage for Activision, Bob Pilaro. To his left, joined Atari after a brief stint at Hewlett-Packard and produced Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., and Atari's biggest selling original game, and really a wonderful piece of software, Yar's Revenge, Mr. Howard Scott Worship. And excuse me, I kind of jumped the gun on that. Let me pitch your DVD so you don't have to. You did a fantastic documentary called Once Upon Atari, and you can go and buy this on DVD now for $20.
$20 on sale at the booth.
The Classic Gaming Expo booth, is that it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and honestly,
that's a very good point you're making there, actually.
What's that? That it's on sale?
Yeah, that is good, too.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, no, really. I have not been paid in any way to tell you that it is really a fantastic, really fascinating look at you know, got together all of his old Atari designer friends and just pretty much, you know, went to town and interviews, and there's some funny stories there, mostly involving marijuana.
There's quite a bit of that.
Yeah.
And, not just marijuana.
Not
just
no, there were other drugs. So yeah, and finally on the far left, another, it's right here. I just don't want to miss anything. And a man who gave us, you know, what could be considered the game that at a very crucial time. Saved the American video game industry, the VCS version of Space Invaders, as well as Maze Craze, and designed the sequel to Asteroids, Space Duel, with Mr. Rick Maurer. That's it for me. Take it away.
Well, geez, we didn't do any management decide who was going to start first, so
I'll give it to the guy.
Actually, I guess I'll start out with just something brief. I don't know if people want to say things or just open it up to Q&A, but I've been in the game business since 77, and then I've been pretty much out of it for about, well, out of the game business since like the late 90s, doing some other stuff. But for any of you that are designers out there, one of the things that was really cool back when we were together at Atari in the early days, and the world's very different, but I think, you know, it's still real important, is to have passion. And, you know, when you're designing games or the animation or the graphics, some of these games, I think Sim 2 had like, from EA, has like 200 people on the project or something. It's just huge. But still, to get your passion in there, to make it fun. And I wanted to ask actually a question, see if anybody got this. So what I think are the two important things of designing a game, the most two important things in a game that's going to be successful?
Creativity.
Okay, and in designing it, yeah, that's probably true as far as what the end result is in a game, what is really important in any game, whether it's a classic game or a current game. Okay, that's one. Well, simple, yeah, it should be easy to learn, difficult to master.
Innovation?
Innovation could be important, but you can get a lot of innovation games that are bad. But innovation is definitely what you want to try for. I think, the thing I was going to say is addictive, okay? You need to be, you know, easy, actually three things, you know, easy to learn, difficult to master, fun, and addictive. And most of the hits that we've had, the ones that were hits, had that. And, you know, that's what's real important in games today and a lot of the games, the classic games that you guys play. So nowadays things are a lot different, but I think that's a real key thing. So anybody else?
Yeah, low price is a very good point also.
$20.
That's...
Maybe we could just open it up to questions and stuff too.
I think that's
that's the way to do it. That's a good start. So anybody has
so if you
any?
You can't remember people's names. You can just say the guy with this kind of shirt or.
We're going to have ET landfill questions. Let's get those out of the way early.
Actually, I wanted to answer a question that was asked at the iMagic set of questions. Someone had asked about doing independent games and stuff like that, because right now most of what happens is when you get those 200 people on a project, they're doing copies of last year's game. And so people want to know, well, so how about making originals and stuff like that? And I wanted to know let you know that some of the people up here have done things like that, and when you try to do distribution, when you're doing things on your own, you get these questions about production values So some of those artists do add something to from those teams.
I've
so,
had that sad comment said to me. Yeah.
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 So when did dawn on you guys that you guys were part of something that turned out to be as big as it was? Was it at the time you were doing the games, or was it a couple years later, or next?
I think it was when the guys left and formed Activision.
Yeah.
Just as far as the effect it had on society, pop culture, worldwide.
I think we thought it was that way. We felt like we were doing something special. But the rest of the world said, that's a fad. It'll be over in a year.
Something like Pac-Man, obviously, it was one of the first totally pervasive things. I think Space Invaders was a huge, huge thing for people who were into games, and it really made things take off. But Pac-Man was one of the first things where you started to see this everywhere. You know, that was, I think, one of the first video games that absolutely everyone, even people who don't play games, knew about. When you started seeing jokes on Leno, and, or, you know, Johnny Carson. Leno was just a kid back then. But that's when you started seeing T-shirts, to see all these kind of promotional things that were mainstream. When you see it in a TV show, you know, that had nothing to do with games, if you wouldn't mention it. That was starting to happen. But I think, like, what Rick is saying is very significant, is that for us, we were, like, and what Jim was saying, too, passion, you know, is huge, right? So we were so passionate, so into what we were doing. This was our whole world. And so it was our whole world. I mean, everybody tends to look at the world like they do, I think. And since this was our whole world, we assumed that a lot of people, you know, that whole world was video games. People who didn't know anything about video games, we didn't talk to them very much because we were mostly spending all of our time at work, so we're only there with other people who are into video games all the time. But there was definitely a point, and that was like around very early 80s, when things suddenly went big and when people like us were starting to get interviews in newspapers. Like, people actually wanted to come and talk to us and tell people about us and not just the games. And that, the world changed at that point a lot.
But earlier, when the games were starting to get big, like 79, 80, we were the only ones that knew how complicated it was to make these games. Everybody else says, oh, that's just games, you know, you just make that in 2 weeks or something, and really important people make traffic signals.
That's a really good point, actually, is that technically, and I think that's still true today, is that games are sort of like the ugly stepchild of software development. A lot of people think games are just games. It's just messing around and stuff. And the fact is, when I went into games, I had two tries. I was a pretty sophisticated software developer designer. You know, I had just gotten my master's. And I had two options, essentially, if I were really going to use my technical training. One was to do video games. The other was to do real-time terrain tracking or multiple target discrimination systems for the government and stuff. Or as we used to say, you know, you can either make games or kill people for 12 cents a head. You know, that was like the choice. And a lot of other software applications, like I went to HP right out of college and I was bored out of my mind because the programming was boring. Games is much more challenging. And even today, systems, the hardware on them is so complex, and it is one of the last bastions of firmware programming where you're really involved with the hardware when you're programming. And the programming in games is a lot more sophisticated and a lot more demanding than a lot of other software development is, but nowadays other software development has always been more recognized. And it's just, it's an interesting anomaly that it's actually harder to do and it gets a lot less respect. And it's just, I think that was always a motivating factor for us, though.
It is interesting that it's true today still, and it was true then. It was true then in a different way because it was just hard to do all these little things and in a small space. Now it's hard today, games with 100 people, 50 people. All these things I learned in college are actually needed. And before, when I did a game, it was after a couple of years I actually needed to use a cosine. And but now you need to know all this. All these things can be in the games and more. You could go back and all the things you learned in college and go back for 4 years and put it in a game. And people just don't realize how complicated they are. They just play them. It's easy.
They now have a computer science degree that you can get in game design. We didn't have that.
Yeah.
No.
No.
Question.
Look at it and say, you know, this is great, I'm going to do my bad job, or, you know,
ColecoVision had the biggest box I've ever seen. Or no, I'm thinking of the Atom, right? Which also ran the ColecoVision stuff. Yeah. That's the only thing I remember about.
Well, I remember a television because I was doing I was trying to do a football game on the 2600, and then it got killed because I couldn't do the graphics that the Intellivision had. But I actually had intelligence in the gameplay, and it never got released. But then I went on to the 5200 and eventually did real sports football, which the Stanford football team, the coach called Atari and said, I don't know what this thing is, but I can't get my team to stop playing it. So I felt like maybe I successfully, but it was a bit scary because Intellivision had better graphics. I mean, it was easier to put better graphics in at that point in time. But Atari, you know, had a lot of momentum going at the time, and I don't think it ever really worried, you know, the top management as far as, you know, I mean, initially it did, but then after a little while it was kind of clear that they had their niche and we had ours, and we had a big, you know, mass market, which is, of course, what the companies want.
I remember looking at that and saying, oh, my, I was scared as just a programmer, not a manager, but because, wow, it looked so good. The graphics were so great. But then 2 days later, it says, why isn't the gameplay that great? I don't understand.
And that's actually a point to add to what Rick's saying, is that we really had to squeeze stuff out of that machine that never was expected to be squeezed out of it. I mean, when we started, we literally had 2K bytes of ROM, no real sound circuit. I mean, nothing you'd call a sound chip. You know, we had like 128 bytes of RAM, That included room for a stack. So, and we had the time. We didn't have any display buffers, so we had the time. We had to do a lot of programming on the fly by looking at the vSync and the hSync and know the cycle timing. We worked with logic analyzers a lot of times to make sure, you know, things fit in the right time. So we had to really focus on gameplay partly because we couldn't focus on graphics. We didn't have room for graphics and used every trick in the book, like for the first chess game, you know, with the striped chess pieces and stuff, and a lot of that in Pac-Man with the flicker. But we had to focus on gameplay. We just didn't have the luxury of focusing on graphics. Yeah. Yeah, he could have.
I've had about 22 years to consider that question. And I honestly believe that E.T. with 2 more weeks could have been a much better game. Absolutely. I mean, E.T. was done in 5 weeks. It was the fastest video game ever done, I believe. Start to finish. That's the part I like about it, is that it was an amazing technical feat, and I think I did it. I took it. No one else wanted to touch it, because I asked. I asked everybody. I got up in the conference room that day. I said, anybody else want to do E.T.? You know, it's doing 4 weeks. You know, oh, no volunteers. It was, and I was stupid enough to do it, you know, which is, you know, it's dubious, you know. So could have been better. Yeah, because I didn't have much feedback time. I didn't have a lot of sleeping time. I didn't have a lot of anything time to do it. But it was just like it was this insane quest, you know, to do this. I just wanted to do something that was this big a challenge. So now you have to ask the question, well, did I really do anything? You know, I made a completed game. It was a fine game. It had play. It had levels. It had a lot of stuff, too. And I think it was a full, complete game, and it was done in a very short period of time. But was it a really good game? The thing I've always known is, for me, it was a great technical challenge, and I really liked meeting that challenge and trying it. At the same time, it's like, for consumers and people who are buying the game, they don't care how long it took to make the game, and they shouldn't. You know, and I never was under any illusion like that. You know, and when people say, this is a horrible game, this is a miserable game, I think, you know, well, that's valid. You know, that's totally true. There are some people who actually like the game. You know, there's, I think, 2, actually. But I never argued with it. I do like it, though, when it's the worst game of all time. I mean, there have been several polls where it's the worst game of all time. And I like that aspect of it because I like, you know, because Yars is like usually one of the top games of all time, and E.T. is usually one of the worst games of all time. So I figure I have the greatest range of any game designer in history. So, but yes, I think it could have been much better. I did want to say one thing. The other thing is, like, you know, when a television came out, scared the shit out of me. Because we were just starting to suddenly make a whole bunch of money, and here's Intellivision, it's going to rain on our parade. And I thought, that was scary. But the person I was really scared for was Bob Pallaro.
I want to say, before Bob, I just want to say something here about this Greatest Range thing, because I had a very similar experience that some website came out with
testing this, huh?
Greatest game in 1980 and the worst game in 1980, and my Space Invaders and Maze Craze made that list.
Maze Craze is on for, like, worst game of all time?
Yeah.
It's a cool game, though. That's insane. Well, I give you the crown.
No, you got all time. I just got 1980.
I don't remember much after 1980, so that's like all time for me.
I don't know why I have two microphones here, but...
you can talk about both sides now.
Anyway, it took an average of 5 to 6 months to complete a game, and Howard did his in 5 weeks, so that's the main difference. And going back to the Intellivision Coleco thing, up until that point, marketing didn't care about our graphics. They just wanted our games out there, and if it had the gameplay, it was fine. And as soon as those games came out, they'd come in with their suit and ties into the lab and say, you know, we really would like to see a round ball in that game, and what can you do about that? So, you know, we said, okay, now we have to redesign everything and take scan lines out for other processes and put it in for the round ball. And I was able to do that in the when I redesigned Real Sports Volleyball, because the first time I designed it, it had a square ball and everything was working fine. And then I just had to add that little thing on the top.
I got to add one thing about the volleyball game, because Bob and I used to take Wednesdays off in the summer and go down to Capitola and get liquored up and play beach volleyball.
Yeehaw!
Research.
I said yeehaw.
Yeah, and when we were down there, you know, we would be sitting, well, you know, I wonder if a volleyball game would go, because volleyball wasn't really a big sport, but, you know, we really liked beach volleyball. We weren't that good at it, although we did beat a good team once. We almost beat them. but we just, you know, that's our thing, and so we talk about it and that. So I was sort of involved in some of the early conceptual things and helped a little bit with the Colonel, because I had more experience at that time than Bob on the 2600, but then Bob turned it into a really fun game. I mean, I played it a lot.
if you look really closely at that game and you look down by the net, there's a little orange box down there, and that's the little container of screwdriver mix that we used to drink while we were playing the game.
Sorry, screwdrivers.
You got front here.
Yeah.
I have a Barbara Walters question.
Oh, no.
Not
if you were
a
three,
but if you got a crap
load of VC
money and you were
going to
start a game company, what platform would you choose and what would you do on that?
You know my answer.
But nobody else does.
Yeah. PC would be the platform. Download market. Try buy. That type thing. Kind of like PopCap games. Be you, Dan?
Maybe the new PlayStation Portable that's supposed to come out. I think portable games are pretty hot.
I was going to say portable platforms in general is what I would pursue, partly because I still like the simpler games. There was somebody talking... what was I talking to? Friday night, I guess, you know, and they were just saying... yeah, it was our dinner that we have here on Friday night before this starts, and saying that, you know, it's something that you can just pick up and play for a little while you're waiting for something, and then pause it or whatever and put it down. Game Boy, the original Game Boy, was just a huge seller, and I mean it had terrible graphics and no color, but I personally like the portables because you can take them around with you. You can make simpler games. They're less costly. I don't know if there's as much money in it. So if I was going to do VC, I'd look at that aspect of it. But just in terms of desire, that's probably what I'd do.
In 1980, when I had a graduation party from getting out of Cal, I had one of the first Apple IIs, and we had a lot of college graduates are now standing around at my place, standing one in a little line, because you could play one at a time to use that Apple II. And ever since then, I've wanted to make games where more people played against each other, with each other, and stuff like that. And so when these guys are talking about portable and mobile and stuff like that, I'm going, yeah, we're finally getting to where I wanted to be 24 years ago. Yeah.
I'm a little biased on that question because just recently I did a job for Jack Specific for their, I don't know if you've seen it, these joysticks that plug right into the video monitors. They have it here at the show. And I was working for Santa Cruz Games, and we did a subcontract for digital clips for Spider-Man version of that game on that you would plug in, like SpongeBob, if you've seen that joystick. And I feel that that's not really the wave of the future, obviously, but there's definitely a niche for that kind of market where people want to pay $20 for a game they could just carry around with them and plug into any TV and make a great stocking stuffer. And it's kind of short-term investment, but I would think that if I were to invest in anything, it would be for that.
Thank you. So, just so I can understand the question, was that a crap load of money or a shitload of money?
Yeah.
Okay. Because for a crap load, what I would do is, now, I actually agree with Keith that, I mean, the first time video games occurred to me was in, like, a Calculus 3 class, like in 1977, before there really were video games out. I just had this idea of, like, this multiplayer terminal thing. I realized how you could do it all with separate terminals. I had this little game fantasy before I was ever going to go into games, and it was interesting. But now, today, I think I've always believed that the computer is a medium for human interaction is much stronger than a person just interacting with the computer. And what I mean by that is multiplayer games where the computer just hosts, I think, is much more compelling than games where you play directly against the computer and that's it. And what I would do now would be multiplayer cell phone games. I think cell phone is the best distributed communication technology right now. If I were going to start a game venture now, it would be specifically creating multiplayer, easily enter and exit interactive games based on cell phones. I think that would be the coolest thing to do right now. Just a thought.
They had games in 77.
Not good ones. You hadn't done Space Invaders yet.
But I did Hangman.
That's good.
There was... I'm still partial to consoles, but and this is a hard time to answer the question because the new generation is about to come out for the top three, and you only want to be on the winner. So you have to guess ahead which one's going to be the winner.
Next which one question. Would you pick?
Next question. Not.
Oh, come on. Which one would you pick?
How about there?
I don't think it would do worse. I think, yeah, boy, you... I think what you would see is you would see a lot more of the movie and a lot less of the game if they did E.T. again today.
Before there was a shitload of money, there was no management. We go in and decide what games to do, and you know, a couple weeks later, say, I'm going to do this, and they didn't bother you. Of course, they wouldn't do anything for you, but they didn't bother you much. Things were later after I left, and Activision left, and iMagic left. But before that time, all I did was watch the game. There was a license that turned... I started the game before the license deal, but even after the license deal, they didn't give any code, they didn't give anything to show how the game worked. I just went and watched it and added the variations.
Actually, Rick makes a huge point there, I think, and that was really a big part about what it was like being there in the first place, and that was there wasn't much management at all. We were all, like, independent game contractors, in a sense, all just sitting there. We just had office space. We had machines. There was very little management. We did whatever we want. Everything you saw in Space Invaders was Rick doing whatever he wanted to do. And there were just some people who were sitting there, well, are you done yet? If you're done, we'll turn the thing over. But they weren't, like, pressuring you to be done, usually. And that changed later. And it's like, you know, much hate to say, you know, the whole Once Upon Atari thing really goes into a lot of that about what it was like being there, working in a place where you have total creative freedom and no managerial oversight. It was an amazing place to work. You know, I got back into games like 5 years ago, and I was just stunned. I mean, it was like future shock, you know, what it was like getting back into games. Huh?
I said you were, because I worked for you.
Oh, yeah. Steve was right there, too. He was a little shell-shocked himself, I think, at the time.
I ran, actually.
I ran Iraq, all those places. Yeah, he tried everywhere to get these things going. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I think one of the toughest things was if you came into Atari as a manager of our group and hadn't been involved in anything even remotely like that before, that was one of the toughest jobs. We shocked a lot of people, let's put it that way. And, of course, now I'm in management, but but it's a different world now. Now you really need teams, but I think what's still important, again, and before I asked what was important or tried to ask what's important in a game, in terms of creating games now, you need the teams, you need the management, you need all these pieces because it's such a big deal. And distribution, I mean, if you're selling to Walmart or Toys R Us, they put rules on a company. So it's very hard for a little guy to compete. But the one difference, again, between writing software for games and other kinds of software is the fine-tuning and the fun element. That's still there, and, you know, there's still good games out there. There's a lot of them that I think are just overproduced and aren't that fun, or at least aren't fun for very long. But it's a very different world, and, I decided I didn't want to program like that anymore in big teams and stuff, but I would rather help direct it and help input to the design and help the game end up being tested well and being fun. Mm-hmm. But it's very much night and day. I think unless you get on the smaller platforms, like, okay, the beginnings of cell phone games and things like that, you know, it's hard to make a mark on your own. You pretty much have to work for a company that's, you know, putting games out on PlayStation, putting them out on Xbox. PC's probably a little easier, you know, to get your game out there. Definitely easier. But, you know, it's a whole different world now.
Yeah, I mean, most of us got into the thing. You wanted to make a game, you had to learn how to program, or you already knew how to program, but programming was a bulk of the catalyst of how you can get the thing done. And then now, being a programmer, you're kind of isolated into a category. You're not really designing the game or anything, and it is the part that I miss, and it's hard to get out of that confinement, actually. Yeah.
Another question? About the whole sword quest thing.
That's not good, but okay.
He would know.
What I wanted to know is, you designed Sword Quest for a floor, right? I was wondering what kind of logic you came up with for how you're supposed to get to the different clues in the game. And on a broader sense, how that whole contest came about and why ultimately it was never finished.
Well, it was basically a marketing concept. We, you know, was part of Warner Communications. Warner owned DC Comics at the time. Marketing said, well, we got this DC Comics group. You know, we think we ought to do a game that somehow ties in a comic book with a video game. And Todd Fry was kind of the main idea guy on the project. I don't know if you other guys were part of it, but, you know, they came up with all these four worlds, and Todd ended up being tied up with Pac-Man and other things. And so I ended up kind of being assigned this project right at the last minute to get something out the door because they had these commitments. And I think I spent, you know, 2 or 3 months on it. It was a pretty fast game. And, you know, we met with the DC Comics guys. We had a storyline that they wanted to follow. I kind of threw the gameplay elements into it. We just kind of, you know, were just trying to throw things together kind of to get a game out that kind of met with what the requirements were. I don't know. That's about all I really could say about it.
What about the, cause like the comics themselves, I thought were pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you ever know what came of the fourth one?
So I did the first one. Todd kind of ran with the rest of them because that's what's kind of his brainchild. I don't know. I think he worked on them. I don't know if he finished the last one. But it probably was. Does anyone remember?
Did he work on Fireworld or Waterworld?
Todd did Fireworld, and then he started to do Airworld, and I don't think they ever really finished the series.
Yeah, I think that
sort of fell apart with Atari.
Yeah, Atari was falling apart at the time, and I just think it stopped.
Yeah, when the company was losing about $1 billion a year, they gave up on the idea of a 50,000 sword being planted somewhere, you know, $50,000 swords.
Yeah.
Who ended up with the prizes that were never...
Those prizes were never created.
No, I...
You mean like the sword and stuff like that? I don't think those prizes
were
ever
actually created. They had a contest, and they did give away the jewel-encrusted sword. At least that's what I was told.
Jewelry.
I mean, I ended up doing a special game with the positions of where things had to be, just for the contest where they flew, I don't know, half a dozen people in or a dozen people into play. I mean, I didn't really get too involved with it other than just doing the game, but I'm pretty sure they did give out the prizes.
John Strunk yesterday, who was at Atari later on, he said that Jack doesn't have the sword. It's not mounted over his mantle when the rumor goes, but it's in a glass box.
I heard it was planted somewhere else.
Or should have been.
Wow.
Ooh,
that's got to hurt.
What would you guys say like the most limiting factor
of
the hardware?
Everything.
The cycle time on a line.
Well, early on, I mean, you know, ROM and RAM were really, really very limiting. Later, when we had more RAM and ROM, probably the limiting factor was still, I mean, you didn't have display buffers. You had to, you know, create the display on the fly. So you always had to write these complicated kernels. Now, you know, there were different tables you could go to for color changes, movement, character display, and stuff that had been created and improved as we had more memory. And so you could make use of those in the later games. But yeah, early on, RAM and ROM, and then when that got a little bit better, it was really, you know, you still had to write a display that ran in sync with the TV scan line, at least as far as I remember.
Yeah.
I think we thought, God, if we only had 6 sprites.
Well, that's true.
That's true, the sprites.
I want to say something about that. Every obstacle was eventually overcome that you guys speak about, the graphics and the speed and memory and all that, just adding ROM chips and the 6-character score kernel and all that was able to give you more graphics. But I think the only factor that remained constant throughout the whole development stage was the joystick, and that you were really stuck with this hardware that never changed. So any game you designed had to still use that one joystick and one button, and then that was it.
It was much more reliable than that 5200 controller we had, so.
Yeah.
Be careful what you wish for.
Although we did have a paddle controller and a digital thing for driving games at one point.
Yeah, but how many people had them?
That's true.
Was that kind of something Atari told you to move more toward
one-player
games?
No, it's actually I think was it Rick said this or one of them said it, but they really didn't tell us. You know, the only thing, in fact, when I started Atari, they said you've got about 6 months to do a game, and here's the equipment, here's the manuals, and here's some people you can talk to. We don't care when you come in. We just got to have the game done. And I said, well, you know, is there some step where you want to see it? And they say, well, no, we want to see it when you think it's done. It changed a little bit as time went on, but for a while, I mean, it really, there was, it was mostly our ideas, and I mean, our ideas is the whole group of people that were there at the time to say, well, you know, we want to try and do 4-player, or we want to do this, there were tests going on back then of, you know, hooking them together and playing multiplayer games, and then it's like, well, then you got to have 2 TVs, and who's going to do that?
put two TVs in. Well, you know, game fanatics would, but the mass population wouldn't. So Atari didn't go for that kind of thing, didn't want to produce that kind of thing. But in the labs, you know, the developers, people were doing experimentation and creation, things like that all the time.
Was it more enjoyable as developers and playing the games to do two-player
and multiplayer games, as opposed to just focusing on one player? Well, you know, for me, you know, when you tested it, you always, you know, had to test yourself against the computer, so you needed another person to help you test your game. And, you know, personally, I was so busy between trying to design the game and get it done and partying, and I didn't want to cut into either of those, you know, that you know, people around would like some games and not like others. Like, I did Flag Capture, and it was kind of a cult game. You either loved it or you hated it. Its graphics really sucked, but it was good gameplay. And I had this guy, Steve Stone, who just loved the game. And so he would take it, and he would play it with his friends and give me feedback. That's my take on it. Others,
well, some of it was, you know, hardware limitations, where, you know, if you had a two-player game, you had to, you know, keep track of two players' information, and, you know, you only got 128 bytes of RAM. You know, you a lot of times want to use that RAM for maybe keeping track of something else, maybe, you know, more graphical type of things.
On the newer system, it's probably easier to set up.
Yeah.
I think almost all the games I did were two-player or more, except for Xevious, while I was at Atari.
And speaking of the multiplayer games, Jim was the model for the guy on the box of Warlords, too.
All right. That's
true. That's important to know.
I had nothing to do with the game, except I actually helped Carl to test it and play it and stuff, because I liked the game. But, yeah, I just got the one in the suit of armor on Warlords. Had longer hair back then and less gray. But
it's also true that it's a very different design challenge when you're making a game. Like, I made games that had multiplayer options, but it was in turn, players taking turns, not playing against each other. When you make a game where a person's playing the computer, that's an AI challenge. When you make a game where people are playing against each other, that's just tuning the environment so to host the play. And that's two different games. And a lot of people don't think about that, but it's really, if you try to do both in a game, you're multiplying the work you have to do to get that game done and the amount of code you need to operate the game in that case. Another thing that was an interesting design thing I always thought about games was the difference between designing an action game and an adventure game. If you think about it, an action game, I always felt that if you do a good action game, the designer should have no advantage in the play of that game over anyone else. You know, that's if it's a good game. There shouldn't be any special tricks or secret things you know about that no one else knows. A good action game, anyone should be able to play it exactly the same. And the thing about that is you can have the experience of a player when you make an action game, so it's easier to test the game. When you do an adventure game, any kind of puzzle game, as the designer, you can never have the experience of what it's like to play that game. And that's a much tougher way to go. And that's the thing when I started to do Raiders that really struck me was, you know, I did Yars, and I knew what it was like to play Yars, and it was fun, I was enjoying it, and that was cool and stuff. When I was playing Raiders, I think about, well, I was constantly putting myself in the space, what's it going to be like to do this? When you have to make up a puzzle and you want to tune how hard it is to do, well, you know what the solution is because you're making it up. It's really hard to gauge that challenge. And so I just always thought that was very interesting. The designing an adventure game, you can never know what it's like to play the game, whereas an action game, you can. I just thought that was an interesting differentiation.
I think Maze Craze was more fun for multiplayers. I enjoyed making multiplayer games.
Somebody went in the back.
There you go.
Yeah, I was just wondering how the marketing is done at that point.
So were we.
Yeah. We were in a separate building at the time, at least when I started in early 82, and I think it was that way before that for quite a bit. So it was kind of, most everybody that I knew was just, they focus on the gameplay, start working it out, and some people would pick projects that were based on like DC Comics or whatnot, and then there was a lot of original stuff going on, but we didn't see a lot of marketing people. You actually had to, I think we had to drive to the Moffitt area to see the marketing people. Actually caught one of them reading a Cybex 6502 manual, one of the Harvard MBAs, Joel Oberman or something. That was quite funny, yeah.
I know, yeah. He came up to me once and said, well, I think I got the lingo down now, yeah. So I'm an expert.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can tell you a marketing story.
Well, go ahead.
You want to hear a marketing story?
Sure. I got one, too.
How Yar's Revenge became Yar's Revenge. Has anybody heard that?
Yeah, that one's good. Before? That should be told again.
This is all about marketing, because marketing used to come with us with the stupidest names and the stupidest ideas, and they knew nothing about what was going on with the games. And when we were working on Yar's, before it was Yar's, it wasn't named, and it was getting to be a really good game. I mean, whatever else you'd say, but it didn't have a name, we didn't know what it was, but it was getting to be a really cool game. And I was starting to think, you know, I don't want them to, you know, screw this up with a really crappy name or do something. I wanted it to be cool. I wanted everything about the game to be cool. So I went to one of the marketing product managers and said, well, what's the game going to be? What do you guys think? And he goes, well, we haven't decided yet. I said, can I make a submission? They go, yeah. So I spent all night that night. And I wrote a backstory. I think it was one of the first times there was a backstory for a game. Nobody ever did this before. I just wrote a whole backstory, and I thought up Yar's Revenge. And Yar, I figured this out. Yar is Ray spelled backwards, and I wrote this story where it all comes in the Rayzac solar system, and Rayzac is Kazar spelled backwards, and Ray Kazar is the CEO of the company. So the next day, I find this marketing guy, and I say, okay, here's my submission. You know, put this in. He goes, okay. He takes it in. He goes there. The day after that, I saw him again, and he goes, so... I said, hey, have they decided yet? Has it made a name? He goes, no. I said, okay, I want to tell you something. I said, but you have to swear to me. You have to promise me you will not tell anybody about this. I don't want it to unduly affect the process. And he's like, okay, whatever. And so I said, look, you know that Yar's Revenge thing I gave you? Yeah. He goes, I said, well, what's Yar spelled backwards? He's like, you know, Ray. And I told him about the Rayzac stuff. He goes, Ray Kazar. He goes, oh, my God, this is Ray Kazar. He goes, does Ray know about this? I said, well, of course. Yeah, I wouldn't do this without telling Ray. I said, but that's why I don't want you to tell anybody. You got to promise me you won't tell anybody. And so he's like, oh, yeah, I won't. I made him swear three times, so I knew he would tell people. You know, and it was, and I knew two things. I knew that he would tell everyone right away about this, and I knew that no one in marketing would have the balls to ever talk to Ray. And I also knew they would just assume Ray was in on it, so that was it. So then a couple days later, he goes, oh, guess what? You know, Yar's Revenge, we're going with it. We're going with that story. Then, oh, I can't believe it. You know, so that was one level of marketing, was how you had to kind of play them if you wanted to get somewhere with them. But later on in Yar's Revenge, there was a guy who I won't name, but we all know him. And this was a guy who was trying to kill Yar's Revenge for some reason. He was always saying the game's not good enough, it's not going anywhere. He was the head of our department. He was trying to kill the game for some reason. We couldn't figure out why, because everybody kind of liked the game. We wanted to play it. So he called for a play test, and the play test is the biggest kind of test you could possibly do. You have over 100 people come in, you play it, and you play it against another game. So here's my little Yar's Revenge. I'm thinking, oh, boy, you know, here's my game. We're going to get a play test. So what's it going to play test against? It's going to test against Missile Command, which was, you know, the hottest game at the time. It was a great game, you know, and I'm thinking, shit. You know, it's like I got a play test against Missile Command. It goes in, and it beat Missile Command in the test. And it was like, you know, well, now what are you going to do to kill the game? You know, it's like, so now they got the, and the thing was that Atari was screaming for games that appeal to adult women. That's what marketing is saying. You know, we want to hit adult women. You know, give us a game that appeals to a market we can't reach. They don't have any ideas on how to do that, but they, oh, yeah, but you know, go ahead, make it, you know. And here it was. The game, this game tested highest with adult women. And so I said to marketing, well, here you go. Here you go. You want to delay it anymore? You want to hold this up anymore? Here's the game that's exactly what you want. And they said, you know, space shooters, they don't appeal to women. It's the test. You know, you did your own test. You know, here it is. And they made all these commercials, and they marketed the game to, like, you know, 7- and 8-year-old kids. And it was just like, no matter what you do or what you'd say to them or what they did themselves, they didn't even look at their own data. It was just, and that's, I think, why we were all so scared of them and so reluctant to deal with them, because it's like, they could just kill you. I mean, it was like, it was just, and they had no idea what was going on.
And they thought, like, we were whacked out, you know.
Yeah. And we were.
They were right, but they were also whacked out.
They were too, yeah.
I got a little story. I remember going to a meeting one time with some marketing guys, and remember the original Atari packaging, the name of the game was pretty pronounced on the side of the box, and then all of a sudden the Atari logo got real big, and the names got real small. Well, their theory was that, you know, people asked for these games because they're usually behind a glass panel or something, and that they wanted, you would order just the Atari game, and you didn't care about the title. So that was the kind of logic we ran into.
And that was the same logic that led to movie titles.
Just on a more personal note, what did each one of you do today?
What do we do today?
Well, yeah, for this line or retirement or, you know, that kind of thing.
It's Sunday.
I'm taking that as a work question, right? What am I doing work-wise?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still designing and programming games, currently on the PC, possibly for this new thing that Bob was talking about, the Jack stuff. It's something I'm looking into. And I've been going through an interviewing process at a certain company I won't mention. That's been quite grueling.
I'm a project manager at Palm. I work fairly closely with Tapwave, who does a small Palm-compatible device that plays games.
What do you want me to do? No, actually, I'm sort of doing a number of things. I have an invention that I patented a while back, and I'm still trying to get it licensed. And it's a 3D hologram nightlight kind of product, a low-cost consumer thing. And so I learned an awful lot about marketing channels and licensing and resources and timing and focus of companies. Some company you go to, you think, oh, they're going to love this. And they do love it, but they go, it's not in our direction for the next 2 years, you know, but get back to us, you know. So that's one thing. And the other thing is I've gotten more into program and project management. Right now I'm doing a little contract for Philips on a medical device, trying to get it out, you know, on deadline.
So I spend most of my time doing real computer jobs, working on compilers and stuff like that. But you still can't take, ew, you know, I still want to play the games I want to play. So if we're talking about the weekend, I'm actually spending a lot of time programming in Java because I'm trying to do things that are online. So I'm trying to get something on the side that I can sell, you know, shareware again or something like that.
Well, up until recently, I was making Java games on the internet for prizegames.com, but they went out of business. So I then started making websites for people. For some reason, I got into that. And just recently, I just finished a Spider-Man game for the for Jack specific, which should be out in October or November or something like that. I'm not getting royalties on it, so don't worry about that.
Well, I'm now the executive producer of Scott West Productions. It's a video production house that I run, and we do documentaries, and I do some nonprofit promotional and instructional video as well.
Well, after the early 70s, 80s games, I wanted to do something more algorithmic, or, you know, some more meaty mathematical tech algorithms. So I did that for a while, and then last 10 years about, I've been back into games.
After Imagic for
Big,
what did Atari do to keep you guys from jumping ship?
I could answer that.
A royalty plan.
What happened was they started after Imagic Forum, shortly after Imagic Forum, they came up with a fairly lame royalty program. And what happened was shortly after that, actually at one point, Todd Fry and I and a couple other people were going to go and form another new software venture, and which I really wanted to do. And I told Todd, knowing Todd, who he is, said, Todd, don't tell anyone. Just shut up. Let's go. But Todd was smarter than that, I have to admit. Todd went, and that company was going to be 20th Century Fox Games. I didn't know that at the time. But it was, which turned out to be a good thing to not go to, because they didn't do too well. Todd went and just went right to our manager, George Kish, and just said, hey, you know, it's costing too much to work here now. You know, what are you going to do? And he said, we're leaving, and like that afternoon, there was a big scuttlebutt among Atari management. I think it was the next day. There was an emergency meeting called for all the programmers, and they started handing out $40,000 checks to a number of us. And that was when the real bonus plan hit. And this is all covered in depth in episode 2 of Once Upon Atari, I'd just like to say. But that was an amazing thing. I mean,
it's a good DVD and video to get to buy.
It's cool. But, I mean, that was an amazing day. That was a life-changing day for a lot of people. I mean, it's, you know, not every day you get called into a meeting and the CEO of your company hands you a $40,000 check and says, we're just so happy you work here. That's going to be a nice thing. I'll never forget it because I got that check. And I looked up at Ray and I said, you know, Ray, you know what I'm going to do with this money? I said, I think I'm going to start a software company. He wasn't too happy about that, but I didn't. But that was that's what happened, and that, and a lot of people say that nothing was ever the same after that day at Atari.
I want to throw in a different angle to that, because Steve and I are the scabs. We came in as replacements for all these guys that went off to Activision and iMagic, and so we just came in because we wanted to do games, and the fact that they were throwing not just icing on the cake, but cake on the cake. Thank all of you guys for having done that.
Yeah, I was at Apple at the time, and then Keith said, yeah, I've been interviewing at Atari, and I was like, I've always wanted to work there. And he and I were kind of working on some graphic stuff, and we had finished the Joyport, I believe, at the time, and he told me how cool it was over there, and I was like begging him to get me in over there somehow. So I ended up interviewing with Rob Zadibble, and first person I saw in the hallway was Howard with the whip and the hat, and I had no idea what was going on there. I was actually kind of a little scared, but then eventually I was made an offer to go there, and it was one of the best places I've ever been. It's just everybody was, they were themselves, and it was really natural, and a lot of cool personalities, and it's never been the same at these other companies I've been at. So, and thanks to him and Todd for doing what they did to create a plan that got us some money for a while.
Right, so if any of you want to start a company and have money to do so, make it fun.
Yeah. Let the people do their work.
You don't get that many chances to do that.
Any investors out there? Help.
We can provide the fun.
Yeah. No investors. Oh, there's an investor.
What? You take fun into the back.
Any other? Over.
Hate them. No.
Well, they kind of snuck them in on us.
I got a story.
Like in the back door, and all of a sudden one day, their competition. Okay? It wasn't like this was planned. Or at least I wasn't notified of it. I don't know if anybody else was.
Yeah, Game showed up and said.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they had decided that another way to get around having to pay us money and all this stuff was to get another group on the East Coast involved.
The Battle Zone story
Steve and I started Battle Zone.
We were just talking about it.
And I went on vacation for a couple of weeks, came back, and Steve said, it's done.
Yeah, I mean, I was just working in there trying to make it look like a wireframe, get the hills scrolling and stuff, and I walked by my manager's office, and we can't even say these names anymore, I guess, but a certain guy. Richard Frick. Anyway, no. and I look in his office, and there's this, I mean, it was a nice-looking game. It wasn't very representative of the wireframe stuff that Battlezone was known for, but it was a complete game. It was done. I just started working on the main kernel with Dan on it, and I was having fun with it. And I said, Rich, what is going on here? And he said this came from GCC. And so I just assumed it was, you know, planned behind our back. And then when Dan came back and I told him, Dan was not happy. No. Dan was my manager. It was cool having a programmer as a manager. And he went in and, you chewed him out pretty good.
it was kind of, you know, they sprung it on us.
Yeah, they sprung it on us. And I think in retrospect, I really don't know how that all came about. Yeah. But I'm assuming that GCC sent the thing in on spec just to show them what they could do.
Yeah. I think they were trying to get contracts. And they sent it in saying, here's Battlezone. We can do this, and this is the kind of quality we can do.
Yeah, and it was like I was hesitant to work on that project just because it was a coin-op game, and there's a lot of expectations, and it's a speccable thing. People have an expectation that's very high. And that was the last time I was ever involved in a conversion just because of that. It just kind of hammered it home for me. But there's a lot of general computing stories that everybody has to tell here that they kept us on guard a lot, though. And they took a lot of our innovations and modified them, and then they looked really good from the outside coming in. So, they were good, though.
Actually, the relationships between us and the other companies that formed out of Atari is a whole different thing. Like, the relationships between the programmers at Atari and Activision and Imagic, that's a whole different thing than the GCC stuff. I don't know if that's kind of what you were alluding to with your question, but we used to have secret summits occasionally with the Imagic guys. We were much closer to the Imagic guys than we were to the Activision guys. The Activision guys were kind of their own cadre, and they just went off and formed a company. I believe, at the time. But the Imagic guys, they formed out of a group that was more of a larger core group where everybody was friendly. So there were times where we would every once in a while get together, and like some of the people from Atari and some of the people from Imagic would get together, and we did something that would have made all the executives at both companies just shit bricks. I mean, we all brought our potential in-development games out and showed them to each other. We all showed them pre-release to each other. It was like, you know, meeting with the enemy and stuff. And we would do this because we all trusted each other. It was like all the execs did not trust anyone. They were always in court suing each other. In the meantime, we are actually showing pre-release games to each other and evaluating and stuff. And that was – it was because we maintained a pretty good relationship. And nothing bad ever happened as a result of that. Because the executive never found out that was happening.
And we had mutual respect because I was asked to take main kernels from my Magic's products and put them in my game, and there's like no way I could do it. You know, I didn't even know these guys, but I knew them through Howard and Todd and whatnot, and it just felt, you know, completely wrong. And I mean, there were tempting kernels to take, but you just couldn't do it. But we were asked to do things like that, and there was a lot of mutual respect for fellow designers.
That was also just something that happened at the time also. I think in the PC games with Sierra Online and stuff, they had all their friends. They would all show their games to each other, too.
Which Imagic games did they ask you?
Oh, yours. No. I think one of them was Bob Smith's game. I think it was the Dragon one or something. I was trying to remember that, but I just didn't buy into doing it.
I really like developing the Raiders game.
Developing Raiders, you know, that was cool. That was long. That was the game that took me the longest of any of my games to do. Because it was, doing Raiders was tough because, like, that was, adventure was out. And adventure was not just a game. Adventure was like a genre and a legend. You know, and it was a brilliant game. Warren Robinette had done an amazing job with that. And so they come to me to do Raiders, and I just thought, you know, shit. It's like, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants. I thought, well, the last thing I can do is do something that's lame. You know, I mean, it's like I felt like if I'm going to do an adventure, it has to be a step up. And adventure was a pretty high bar, I thought. And I had some more memory than Warren had to work with. And so in approaching Raiders, because he did it in 2K, I think, right? Wasn't adventure done in 2K?
Yeah,
and that's an amazing product for 2K, you know. And I had, I think, 8K for Raiders. So that was good. 8 whole K. Yeah, now you can't even do a data structure in 8K. And so I sat down and I decided I wanted to do the biggest adventure game that anybody had ever seen on the VCS. Now, I didn't mean big like Pitfall big where you have 256 of exactly the same screen. You know, I meant big like, you know, different gameplays on different screens and a lot of stuff like that. And that's what I set out to try to do. And I used both controllers, did all this stuff that was kind of weird and kind of odd, and I got questioned about it a lot. But I just wanted to do something that was like a real challenge for the player and a real substantial adventure challenge. Because like I said, it had to be a step up from adventure. And I felt by the time it was done and from the feedback that I got from it that most people seemed to think, you know, I felt I succeeded with Raiders. I felt, you know, I made a pretty substantial challenge game that wasn't impossible, but was there and was bigger and broader than anything else anybody has seen there. I mean, what did you guys think of it? Okay, I'm going to take that as 105%.
You also got to meet Spielberg and stuff too, right?
Well, I met Spielberg more for the E.T. thing. It was like Spielberg saw when E.T. was starting to come up and they were talking to me about that, I think I met Spielberg once while Raiders was going on. Yeah, that's a good story, too. There's a story of when I explained to Spielberg why he was an alien.
Is that in the video?
Actually, that story's not in the video. Do you want to hear that story?
Yes.
Okay, because I got quoted in Game Magazine once. I went to visit Spielberg to show him Yars and talk a little about Raiders. This was a little bit pre-E.T. And what happened was I got to hang out with Spielberg for a while, and he was a pretty cool guy. And we were talking. At one point, I explained to him, I said, you know, I think you're an alien. He goes, well, why do you think that? And I said, because I think that, you know, when the aliens come down to Earth, they're not just going to come up in a spaceship. You know, we're going to discover they're already among us, because if they're smart enough to get here, they're smart enough to send a little recon team, you know, and do something like that. And so I said, well, you know, your movies, look at your movies like, you know, Close Encounters and E.T. and stuff like that, because the movie was already out. And I said, you know, I think that it's not just, you know, you're making such great movies. I said, I think there's like this whole team, and Spielberg makes these movies, and these were some of the first movies that showed aliens in a positive framework, right? And then he's got the marketing team of aliens who go out and make sure that these movies get translated in every language, are seen all over the world. So it's like this culturalization process that he's a part of, and what they're doing is they're preparing Earth to positively receive the aliens. And that's why the movies are so nice to aliens, and that's why they make sure everybody sees them. So I just explained this whole thing, and I said, that's why I think he's part of this alien team. And he called up Game Magazine, or he did an interview with them, and he told them they should call me up and get this quote, and I ended up with quote of the month in Game Magazine for calling Spielberg an alien. So that was fun. That was a fun part of making video games.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you didn't want to help the aliens.
No, I end up doing E.T. because Spielberg said, you know, I want Howard to do E.T.
Dave.
And you can have 5 weeks.
I just wanted to know if they worked in the 5200s. Any comments about what that was like?
Well, I was one of the first to work on the 5200. I actually got involved in with Rob Zadibble, I think, in helping do some port control interface software and stuff. And I have to admit that I actually came up with a concept for the 5200's controller, the design with the keyboard and the stick and that, but I did have no control over the internal mechanism, which kept falling apart. In fact, I got kicked off the project because I was so adamant. They decided to use this real cheap mechanism, and when there were better mechanisms available, it cost a little more, of course. But that's what ended up killing the 5200, was the controller, the poor mechanics inside of it. But for me, the 5200, I mean, well, essentially it's an 800, 400. I mean, the same basic internals. It just had different controller ports, basically, and more, four instead of...
How many of the 800 have it? Four, didn't it?
I don't remember.
I was initially hired to work on that thing, and I said, why would I work on it? Oh, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, but I was going to say it was a lot more fun in the sense that, I mean, I wanted to do better football games and, you know, really do a football game and get it released. And so I had a lot of fun with it. I liked it, but the problem, again, was that they had, I think it was a 90-day warranty on the controllers. And the average length of time the controller would last and get returned back was about a little over 21 days. So do the math. You're going to go broke at some point real quick. And the 5200 actually sold 1 million units, okay, back then. In its debut, first several months. And then they decided we can't, you know, continue with this. And then there was the 7800 that was competing and stuff. And I guess it came with better controllers. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. Anybody else want to talk?
Well, I, as the other 5200 programmer here, I wanted to throw in that you know, I came in after the royalty plan, and if you were really interested in the royalty plan, you got paid for more carts being sold. So that would have said 2600. But I've always wanted to play games that I wanted, and I wanted better graphics. And for the magic that these guys had to do to make the shapes they did, I still took the easy way out where I could have a bit field and stuff like that. So I just did it because I wanted the graphics. I love that Antic chip.
I did it because I wanted the money. I went over to from the 5200, which is what I was originally hired for, and I said, why do I want to work on that? It's not even out yet. You know, the 2600, there was, I think at that time, 20-some-odd million. And so my manager was quite upset that actually hired me. He's Don Tizer or whatever. And so he got the Atari 2600 manuals and threw them down my side and said, here you go, you know. And so I just started working on it like that and tried to meet people that knew how the thing worked. I think I ran into you and you showed me some stuff. But originally they were trying to hire a bunch of people to do 5200 stuff. And I just didn't see the numbers there. And I'm glad I went the way I did. But, you know, I understand your side of it too, because you know, you can really make things look good and whatnot.
And part of it too was the more senior people, and this was what was weird with the royalty plan, was the more senior people in general got put on the newer machines, and because there were, at that time, there were a lot more people on the team. We had, I don't know, 40 people. I don't remember how many, but it was easier to train a new person on the 2600 because it had been around a lot. There were a lot of examples, example code, people to coach you. They put more of the senior people, but we made
I think more per cartridge, but way less cartridges would sell because you got a million installed base instead of 20 million or 15, 20 million, whatever. So some of us were a little upset with the royalty structure, you know, based on that. And then we also had to train some of the new people on the 5200. But since it was so similar to the 800, there was, you know, a fair amount of knowledge base within Atari even at that time.
You had a question over here?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm a big fan of 5200, and I've spent $100 on controllers and controllers. Now, the question I have, why
wasn't there somebody partial to that patent that was working there or something that was working on it? What's that guy?
Craig?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I'm not sure if I can answer that. I think there was a patent that Atari had on that. And I know there's other companies where you can get controllers that apparently work better and last longer. Yeah, I mean, I just it's been a while since I brought the 5200 out and played it, you know, played it. But you know, by then I'm not sure. Maybe I don't understand your question exactly. But I mean, you know, by then it was dead, so Atari wasn't going to pursue it. But as far as why they didn't come out, you know, like with a better controller before killing it, I think it was probably a patent issue, probably a timing issue, and strangely enough, a cost issue that doesn't make any sense in looking back at it, because one of the main reasons, I mean, you know, the remote controls for airplanes and cars and stuff that people had, that mechanism worked absolutely fine and would have been perfect for the device. But I did learn something from that, and at Sega, when I was working at Sega, I came out with the mission stick for the Sega Saturn, and that was my creation. I mean, I had a team that actually made it, but that was really nice because we didn't have any potentiometers. It was all done with infrared, you know, measurements, a technology that we licensed. But back then, I mean, you know, Atari just didn't... Well, you know, and they just weren't thinking back then, too.
Yep.
Well, we hear a lot about what the target platform was like to work on, but what kind of development systems did you actually use?
Was a VAX tied to a televideo terminal and a big black box, which I don't know what brand that thing was. But I remember
it was
saying...
It was home-spun, I believe.
So yeah.
The debugger was made by Nichols.
Yeah, because
pretty primitive.
I remember going to this private showing of an Apple II development unit called the Frog Card or something like that, Frog or whatever. And I went there because I wanted to build games on the side, you know, while I was still at Atari, because I didn't know where that was going, Atari. And I get there, and there's my manager that hired me, Don Tizer, and he's like, "What are you doing here?" And this was in Santa Cruz. It was like a house and a business. It was really a strange environment. And so I bought one of these cards, and I told him, "Oh, I'm just using it for research purposes, just in my spare time, so I can learn more about the 2600." And he really frowned upon it. But then I was mentally thinking, you know, I got to push this as a development system for everybody here because we can compile much faster, yada yada yada. And I get back to work, and we had a whole team of people running these VAXes, and I just felt really sad about bringing up something I know could make them obsolete instantly, you know, and I kind of kept it to myself. Not that they would have listened and substituted all the VAXes with Apples, but it was definitely the way to go. And I forgot the original point of what I'm making here. But
I was asking about what we developed on.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah, some big black box tied to a green screen.
One other thing we had was, at least some of us used, was HP Logic Analyzers.
Oh, yeah, that too, yeah.
You know, for the timing. So there was somebody, and I forget his name right now, Linbug, so it was Larry Nichols, I believe, yeah. He had a debugger that you could download your code into from the VAX, I guess.
Yeah.
And originally, I think we started with PDP... 11s?
Yep.
11s, yeah. Another PDP somethings. So and then we had logic analyzers, and we had this homegrown debugger.
Yeah, so even when we went to VAXs, we were still running PDP 11 emulation mode. Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I didn't really know how to use that HP single step thing. That thing was massive, but it was a perfect angle to hold my listings. You know, and then, it was perfect. And I used to just program in little stumps, and then when something didn't work, I knew it was that.
It was great for when, you know, you spent too much time and the screen rolled, and you could, you know, put points in there and see how long it took and figure out approximately what went wrong.
Yeah, that's true.
You could step through and see the code. Ah! I did this.
But they had cool buttons. They felt cool when you pushed them. Yeah. Big soft buttons.
Let's see. Back there on the sort of yellowish.
I wanted to go back here more. Well. Like you're talking about HP Analyze. I don't remember any of those until we went down into CoinOp. I used them. And I know he must have a desk at an office, but all I remember is being in the lab because that's where the debug station was. Mm-hmm.
I know someone threw one when Sinistar got canceled. That was true.
another thing that we should give credit to these Activision guys. They said that those four guys were a cohesive group, and they went around together, and they didn't talk to everybody. Well, I mean, they would talk to people, but they preferred their own company. But they started that all because a couple of them made this first debug station. There was nothing there. They made this debug station out of a KIM 6502 kit that had 8K of memory rather than 2K. But that was, there wasn't very much else to it. And you carried your code around on an 8-inch floppy disk and made changes to it. And you could single step through, but we didn't. I don't remember using analyzers there.
That's an easy one for me.
Jack Tramiel.
Jack Tramiel was going to buy the company.
Is he here?
Bastard. The company went through massive layoffs, and at some point, you know, the morale got so bad that you either decided you want to try to continue to do this or not. In my case, it was, you know, I felt it was inevitable, and I was ready to try something else at the time.
I think Bob is the only one that survived Tramiel, isn't he? Right?
Yeah, I think that might have been.
Well, thus, Zdibble was the last.
Zdibble. Yeah, Zdibble was there forever.
Yeah. I think he's still there. Yeah.
Tramiel was it for most of us.
I stuck around till I couldn't take it anymore. after Tramiel bought the company, they got rid of almost everybody except maybe 20 engineers. And they then took away our offices, stuck us in cubicles, took away our phones. We had one phone for the whole group, and cut our salaries in half. And those were going to be advances on royalties. So then it was time to leave.
Yeah. We had no idea. I mean, what those guys were getting the company for was for nothing. I mean, if we would have known, or at least what I've known, what I found out last night, we could have pulled together and bought the company. And it was just a disgusting piece of news to hear last night. But
it's cheap. Do we have time for like one more question?
What was it like, Bob? What was it like when you wrote Defender for the 2600?
What was it like?
Yeah.
It's kind of a generic question, isn't it?
It was fun.
Well, I had actually...
It's like a box of chocolate.
It just basically rolled in the coin-op game.
I had started designing Defender, and then Todd Fry was working on Pac-Man. And then after we were both doing our designs on it, then they asked us to switch projects, and I decided to stay with Defender just because I thought it was a better game. And I just really enjoyed working on it, except that I had a hard time figuring out how to get all those controllers into a joystick game. And I just kind of hacked the idea of just dropping down below the city to emulate certain actions, that kind of thing. But... It took about 6 months to work on that, so by the time I finished, I was pretty much tired of it. And they didn't start the royalty plan until after that, but our projects, but it was all based on what was done by a certain time anyway. So I had no idea what was going to happen with it.
Yeah, I think we're going to make room for the next group coming up soon. But does anybody have any like final comments and stuff? You want to get Jan in there?
Jan, here's a celebrity Jan. Here, a star.
Jan was there.
Jan Baum. My name is
the EEPROM person.
You were one of the last ones there. Well, I was across the street, 1272, I guess it was, in what used to be the manufacturing building. Larry Brown and I, who was the purchasing manager, I used to release all the patterns. And so they didn't know, Jack Tramiel didn't know who I was, but on Wednesday they called us all in to get badges and new badges. Friday I was fired, like everybody else, laid off.
Wow.
There was nobody left in that building.
There
might have been 12 people.
What a nice guy he was, huh?
Okay. Do you have any final comments you
want to
make? Or?
Oh. Wait, we squeeze final another comments. Question. Go ahead. Backward compatible with the 2600? I don't know if there was any discussion on that. It would have been brilliant to do, but
they tried to do this with a thing called Superstella. I think was going to be backward compatible.
But the 7800 was going to be able to handle the 2600 stuff, I thought.
Right, and it did that, but that was later. I think there was an adapter that somebody made that could plug into the 52.
Yeah, I don't think on the 5200 they did. They just said we need a newer console. Well, we got this 800 chipset and everything, and it's really good, and let's turn it into a game system.
That would have been a smart move to do, though.
Now, one of the first questions someone had was the question about the Odyssey, and I have a feeling that people were thinking we've got to address that rather than the compatibility. So,
huh?
The graphics. They need better graphics.
In other words, needed a game system that had better graphics.
Right.
Television.
But I mean, could have done emulation on that thing to run an old software catalog to get people to bridge
it. It wasn't the main thing that they were thinking of. They just said we need something better graphics-wise. And I think that's all the planning was.
So there wasn't a lot of thinking.
So,
we have a group behind us, or what's going on?
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
So, any final comments?
I mean, they're not right behind us. They're waiting out there, I think.
Do you have a final comment? Come on, you always have a final comment.
Come on out.
I think I've made my final comment.
Okay. Well, then I guess that's it.